Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is our responsibility to the people of Darfur? In 5 years of savage oppression by Arab peoples, unchecked by the Khartoum government, more than 2 million Sudanese have been driven from their homes and at least 200,000 have died. And while the UN recently pledged 26,000 international peacekeepers to stabilize the situation, just 9,000 troops are in place now. And they lack supplies as basic as UN blue paint for their helmets, let alone enough helicopters to patrol a region as large as the state of Texas. So thousands of unarmed aid workers and hundreds of thousands of refugees remain in mortal danger. Ruth Messenger is director of the American Jewish World Service, which has put the Darfur crisis at the forefront of its humanitarian initiatives. She's in town at the invitation of the Jewish Community Relations Council of Greater Dallas, and her 7:30 address at Temple Emmanuel on Hillcrest in Dallas is free and open to the public. Ruth, welcome to Think.
Thank you very, very much, Chris. Delighted to be here.
You think at this stage the Khartoum government is still deliberately waging genocide simply by keeping people warehoused in these refugee camps. Can you talk about that?
I actually think it's much worse than that. I loved your opening because you got all the facts out. And the only word that I would question was you sort of said unchecked by the government. I would say it's perpetrated
committed
by the government.
Mm-hmm.
So historically, over these last 5 years, and I've been there three times. I've been to Darfur once. I've been to Chad twice on the ground. Whenever you ask anybody in any one of the camps, could you tell me your story? First of all, they're eager to tell. And they say to the translators, tell her I want her to know everything that happened because I want her to go back to the West and tell people so this will stop. And then the story they tell, the thing that's most chilling about it is how similar it is, person to person, camp to camp, because everyone's story is more or less. First, the airplanes came. And they bombed our little village. And then, let me interrupt myself, that's the key word there, airplanes. Because there's no tribe, there's no sect, there's no militia that has an airplane. The airplanes are airplanes of the Sudanese government. And we finally were able to make public about 2 years ago that one of the devices of the government is to paint their airplanes white and write UN on them, so that the people will think it's a humanitarian aid plane. So these planes basically, you know, the old word, they strafe the villages. They drop car chassis out the back. They firebomb the villages. They're deliberately trying to smash down some housing. And, of course, the housing is mud and straw, so it's not very hard. And to kill some people and to frighten the people in a village. Then those people run out. And as the story goes, they'll tell you, then the Janjaweed rode in. Janjaweed is an Arabic word that means devil on horseback. It's the old, not old, but the camel grazers, very poor. They've been promised by the government that they'll get camels, horses, guns, and trucks if they just go in and kill their neighbors. And for reasons that, you know, most of us in the quote-unquote civilized world don't know how to understand, it's historically the case, other genocides bear this out, that people can be turned into agents of a government that's intent on destroying people simply because of who they are. So the government has perpetrated this. And yes, your question, which I think is the critical question, is does it continue today? Yes. And in some ways, it's more diffuse because there's so many different groups and so many people disrupted already from their own villages, 2.5 million now displaced from their homes. The government recently launched an attack on the first wave of UN peacekeepers and then said, oh, we didn't know they were peacekeepers. We misidentified them. What does that tell you? But recent reports are about 30,000, 40,000 people a month still being displaced from their homes. And sometimes you wonder, are there any intact villages left? But the government just seems intent on being as disruptive of people's lives as they can, essentially leaving people, and here you said this very well, in leaving people in limbo in these camps. And I just want to say a word. People lived in villages, little tiny farming villages in the Darfur Desert of 200 to 300 people. They're now living in camps of 40, 60, 80, 100,000 people, tents as far as the eye can see.
You talk about limbo, and you've written about this, that people are in this sort of permanent state of not knowing what's coming next. And it's so easy to think about the plight, think about them being hungry or cold or hot. But the psychological damage of just not knowing what's coming, of the young people having no education and no hope, I wonder if you can talk about that a little bit.
I think the psychological damage is huge. I want to say it's, first of all, not knowing what's going to happen. In a sense, Chris, it's almost also not knowing what happened. I mean, why did this happen? Why did our neighbors turn on us? We were a peaceful village. Whose plot is this? What do they have in mind? What are they trying to do? And then, of course, there is frankly no family in a camp, no one you talk to, who didn't experience the trauma of violence in their families. So women were raped and branded, not untypically. They're then disowned by their husbands. Many people saw a husband or a wife slaughtered in front of them to terrify them. I met family after family that would describe losing family members during this attack. I met a woman in the camp in Chad on my last trip who explained that she remembered looking out of her own hut to her field, her agricultural field, and her husband and her teenage son were there. And she saw a bomb fall from the sky, or a gunshot, she wasn't sure which, kill her husband. She saw him fall. And she ran out to protect her son. And the next thing she remembered was waking up over a week later in a hospital, missing a leg. So she lost her son and her husband. And as she said to us, I live in the camp now, but I'm on crutches. I can't even go and get in line and get my own food. So I have to depend on my neighbors.
Let's talk about conditions in those camps. Initially, people were told, don't build anything permanent. This is going to be temporary. You're going to be here for a short time, and it's going to be a problem if you put up anything permanent. And everybody listened. And now it's been 4 years, 5 years, and actually the orders have changed.
Well, the orders have changed, but, you know, this is the world wasn't really made to solve these large problems. 2 million of the 2.5 million people who fled their villages are still inside Darfur. So the camps therein are called camps for internally displaced persons, which means that they're not so far from where they lived, but they know they can't go home. A couple of 100,000 went across the border into Chad, the neighboring country to the west. They did that on the premise that it was safer to get away from their government. And the good news about crossing a border is that the camps you're in are then officially refugee camps. They're set up and overseen by the UN. But you're right that in all of the camps, the message was, look, take a piece of plastic sheeting, put up, these are warm climates, put up a couple of poles, put the plastic sheeting over it and sort of set up housekeeping there. And people did it. Now when you go, you can see these white plastic or green plastic sheets that belong to the UN stretching for miles. And on our most recent visit to Chad, we saw that this plastic sheeting is very effective until it rains. And during the rainy season and the windy season, where there's wind and sandstorms as well, it literally shreds. So there's no protection from the sky.
And there's no, so much has been used for firewood surrounding these makeshift camps that there's no way to even build a structure anymore.
That's right. Well, there's no way to build a structure, and for sure, and we never seem to think about this really, think this through, there's no way to cook the food. So people who were subsistence farmers in villages who had a few chickens and goat and were growing things out of this red desert earth, which is really amazing in and of itself, they've now deliberately, they've been chased away from their farming villages. Their villages have been burned and razed to the ground. In the camp, they're fed by the United Nations World Food Program, which means going and waiting online and waiting online and waiting online and having your card stamped to get some cooking oil, to get some flour, some, if they're lucky, to get some cornmeal, which they prefer to flour. And then you can't, of course, feed people with what you get without cooking it. But you're in a tent compound. You have no stove. You have no firewood. And the way to get firewood is, if you're lucky, to own or rent a burro donkey. But the women who go to collect the firewood have to go further and further from the perimeter of the camp to be in a place where there's any wood left. And what they say to you is, it would be, we would like to send our men and boys, but if they're found by the Janjaweed, then we know they'll be killed. If we're found, we'll probably only be raped.
Ruth Messenger is my guest. She's director of the American Jewish World Service, in town to speak about our responsibility to Darfur tonight at an address to the Jewish Community Relations Council of Greater Dallas. You have said that you would like the U.S. to take the lead on humanitarian aid provision and resettlement efforts for refugees. What are we doing right now?
Well, part of the Darfur problem, I want to say two things. Part of the Darfur problem is, like many of these situations, it's complicated on the ground. So where do you focus your first energies? On the people who aren't getting enough food because the World Food Program isn't fully funded? On the people who want the governments of the West, as I said, to intervene to stop the violence? So there are lots of roles for the U.S. I would say, first of all, the people need immediate humanitarian aid and relief. We at American Jewish World Service are very proud of the fact that in the last 3.5, 4 years, we've raised over $5 million just for Darfur. We've spent about 75% of that on humanitarian aid, on everything from rape counselors to a safe structure at a field hospital to allow for maternal deliveries so that babies won't die, to educational and recreational activities for kids. You were talking about the psychological damage in the camps before. There's nothing to do all day.
No school.
So, no school. In the UN refugee camps, there's an hour or two of schooling a day. We at American Jewish World Service are currently involved in launching a bigger effort several different places around the world, including Darfur and Chad, to provide educational and recreational services to children living in camps because it's one of the forgotten pieces of the world. But so what would I like the U.S. to do, you ask? Here's this curious situation. The U.S. government stepped out early in 2004 and recognized Darfur as a genocide, both the Congress and the White House.
The only country to do so at the time.
Absolutely. And the first time that a genocide has been identified as a genocide while it was happening. So those of us who had just started getting active on this issue were like incredibly empowered. Okay, the government's there. They're going to deal with it. And it feels like they put it at the bottom of their to-do list, and they just haven't gotten down the list because their rhetoric is inconstant. They're not on every case. They're not pushing in the Congress to get the dollars out. They're not pushing with allies to get a more coordinated Western response. They dithered and dilly-dallied in the UN to try to produce the resolution that eventually led to the peacekeeping force. I'm not suggesting to you, Chris, that it was easy. But I'm saying it just never got near the top of the president's list. Okay, so what would we want most right now from the government? The first really simple issue is some more dollars. The humanitarian aid budget is going to run out. People in Darfur have twice had their calorie allotment cut from 2,200 to 1,600 calories. Just let's be sure we're fully paid. And by the way, use that and allow the UN to use that to go and build the rest of the world. Say the U.S. has stepped up to the plate. So that's the first thing is funding, full funding for humanitarian aid, much of which will then go through not us, but some of the larger international organizations that are doing health clinics, that are doing water and sanitation systems in the camps. But the second thing,
we're going to take a quick break.
Okay.
We'll get back to the second thing in a minute. Ruth Messenger is my guest. She's director of the American Jewish World Service. She's talking about our responsibility to Darfur. We'll return to our conversation in a moment. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and travel start in March. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Ruth Messenger. She is director of the American Jewish World Service. She'll be speaking tonight about our responsibility to Darfur at an address that will take place at 7:30 at Temple Emmanuel on Hillcrest in Dallas that will be free and open to the public. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Ruth, you were saying before, the first thing that we need to do is fully fund our humanitarian efforts from the United States. And second?
And second of all, which you referenced in your question, fully fund the peacekeeping. The UN voted this 26,000 peacekeeping force. Sounds like a lot of people. But Darfur, as you noted, is an area the size of Texas. And there are all these little skirmishes and government attacks and attacks on humanitarian aid workers, and truck drivers aren't safe when they're bringing in the food. So all of the experts say that the UN force needs to be this big. Well, the Bashir, the president of Sudan, is putting up as many stumbling blocks as he can to actually having this force formed and allowed into the country. But he's got a little bit of power on his side because he keeps saying to the UN, well, what if I let you move in all these troops? How are you going to move them around the country? And so there are no trucks that are dedicated to the peacekeeping force. There are no helicopters, which is what they most need. So I would like to see the U.S. Second thing I'd like to see the U.S. do is say we are absolutely committed to this peacekeeping process. Sudan can't keep putting obstacles in the way. China can't keep protecting Sudan. And we're right now announcing that we're funding the budget for the big chunk of the peacekeeping work, and we're loaning the UN X number of American helicopters. We hope other nations will step up and do the same because the UN needs a minimum of 24 helicopters to successfully and effectively deploy this force throughout the region of Darfur.
So the U.S. has committed the helicopters.
No.
So
you want to know what I wanted. It was okay. My dream speech.
I was going to say, because I know that former Secretary General Kofi Annan has said he can understand why some countries won't put troops on the ground, but he cannot understand why we can't find the spare equipment.
Exactly. And so it's the equipment. It's maybe funding for some of the training. It's what we know how to do. We don't need to be the people supplying troops. We need to do the things that we know how to do well.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Malia in Dallas. Hi, Malia.
Hi, Chris. I was listening to the program, and thank you so much for having our guest. I wanted to mention about the program that I work with. I work with a program called the Unaccompanied Minors Program out of Lutheran Social Services, which is a nonprofit here in Dallas and several other cities. And this is a great way. What we really do is we get unaccompanied minors, 0 to 17, who are refugees from countries like Sudan and Myanmar, Liberia. We get these kids and we basically place them with families wanting to do foster care. So these kids, get to be with a foster family. A lot of these kids are orphaned or displaced, like your guest was talking about. And, one way we help is sending food or money. This is really extending ourselves to nurture a child who's been through so much, give them stability, give them the skills. And they pretty much age out and get to go to college or work whatever they please. And they can get more information at www.lsss.org. And the number is 972.
You know, we'll put the link on our website. Thank you very I really appreciate your call and letting
okay.
us know about that.
Wonderful.
Thank you so
you.
Much.
Thank you.
What do you think about programs like that?
Well, I think you have to be very careful. On the one hand, there's a history here from Sudan, the so-called lost boys of Sudan, who clearly had lost their families and walked sometimes for years across Sudan into Ethiopia, Eritrea, were in refugee camps in Kenya, and some of them got resettled in the United States and are very successful. But on the other hand, the people that I meet, there's just a culture of taking in and taking care. Somebody's lost a parent. There's a aunt or a grandparent who will be responsible for those kids. What they want is to hold as much of the family together as possible. And not let people fly all over the world, but have the peace come to their region and be able to go back home. And I'm sure your caller knows this, but there was a bit of a problem with this issue just recently because there was a French not-for-profit agency that came into Chad and took a whole plane load of kids back to France to be, quote, adopted, except it turned out that those kids all had parents.
Do you think that's a case of people genuinely wanting to do the right thing and recognizing the comforts of Western society and of living in an affluent, peaceful country, but not sort of culturally understanding the people they're trying to help?
Well, I think that's very often the issue. We were talking during the break. American Jewish World Service works in 36 countries around the world, separate from our Darfur work. And in those countries, we're finding small grassroots groups that may be starting a microfinance fund, that may be trying to open up better access to education for girls, that may be just improving their agricultural techniques. Over and over again, what they want is make things better where we are. Let us expand our culture, our vision, our hope for the future. We may need some outside technical assistance. We may benefit from a group of volunteers. We can apply to AJWS for a grant. But what we want to do is improve life here, and we try to maximize that level of cultural sensitivity and help people do what they most want to do, where they want to do it.
Given the level of human suffering, it's almost a strange question, but how did AJWS choose Darfur as a focus area?
It was a very conscious maneuver. That is, many of the places we work, I think I've sort of said this, they're like under the radar. You don't know that there's a spectacular program in Zimbabwe working to keep girls in school and protect them against rape. But we can find those programs. And then, of course, there are world so-called disasters that everybody knows about. There's a tsunami, there's an earthquake, and we also respond. Darfur was an unusual situation. We came to understand that there was a genocide. And by the way, we came to understand it largely because of the brilliant writing of Nick Kristof of the New York Times, who started writing stories, then eventually started publishing photos that someone had snuck out to him. So we said, okay, what are we going to do? There's a genocide. By and large, the world doesn't know about it. It needs people to both be providing humanitarian aid and relief and to be educating and organizing to stop the genocide. Because we do international work and because we're a Jewish organization that knows that part of the history of the Holocaust is that too many people around the world did nothing, we said we have to commit to Darfur. We have to stay committed to Darfur. It's going to take a long time. People are going to suffer from what's called compassion fatigue. They're not always going to want to do the next thing. We've been successful in spreading lots of public information about Darfur, in having a website, ajws.org, where you can go at any given time and take action, talk, be in touch with your congresspeople about the issues I just raised. Tell George Bush not to go to the Olympics if China doesn't help stop this genocide. Lots of things that individuals can do. We want to keep telling people in our community. And as a member of the Save Darfur Coalition, which is a much broader enterprise, I want to tell a lot more people it's no longer appropriate to be a bystander. Become an upstander. Get out there and do something.
Let's talk about the Olympics issue for a minute. There are two ways of looking at that. Some people say it's the perfect tool for pressuring China. Certainly, China's very concerned about its international reputation. Other people worry that if this becomes a major focus of efforts, the Olympics will be over by the end of the summer, and that tool will be gone, and many people will have felt as though they've sort of completed their obligation to pressure China, and that's it.
I guess we'll look for another tool at that time and tell them what else they need to do. I think this is a real window.
Mm-hmm.
I think China, Sudan has been able to continue her almost inexplicable attacks on portions of her own population because she has the protection of one of the largest powers in the world, if not the largest power. China depends on Sudan for oil. China supplies Sudan with weapons, which are given to the militia to go kill their neighbors. So it's like all out there. You can trace the exchanges. And as long as China is Sudan's protector and enabler, there's no reason for Sudan to change any of her practices. The question is, can we use these few months before August to get China, if nothing else, Chris, to get anxious enough at the level of protests that may surround the Olympics to say to Sudan, as she has begun to do, get your act together. Just let these peacekeepers in, because it's reflecting badly on all of us.
Japan is another major trading partner for China, obviously smaller, less politically powerful in the world today. Has Japan applied sufficient pressure?
I don't think anybody applied sufficient pressure, frankly. And I'm encouraged right now. There's now a group of Muslims in a variety of European and North African countries that are themselves about to speak out and say this is genocide. It's Muslim-on-Muslim genocide, but we have to call it what it is. You know, I was so hopeful about 6 or 8 months ago because the new Prime Minister of Great Britain, Gordon Brown, and the new President of France, Nicolas Sarkozy, together wrote an op-ed which appeared in the leading newspapers of their two countries about we can't let this genocide continue. And I thought, okay, real allies, they'll push Bush, Bush will push them, they'll get Germany and Japan involved. It was like the same thing. It's like, okay, we wrote our op-ed, now we can forget about this for a while.
Ruth Messenger is my guest. She's director of the American Jewish World Service. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to Mel in Dallas. Hi, Mel.
Hello. I have a question for Dr. Messenger. How do we understand the apparent Muslim philosophy that says that certain parts of the world are theirs and theirs alone, and that they get to persecute anybody that isn't, by their definition, faithful? How can we live in the 21st century with a huge population that has that philosophy as its animating force?
Well, first of all, I just want to make clear, it sounds like you might be clear, Mel, but I want to make clear this genocide is Muslim against Muslim. This is a perceived difference by the Bashir government that the people of Darfur are not sufficiently fundamentalist, not sufficiently Islamicist, not sufficiently Arab, because they value and respect their own African cultural heritage. So it's one of these genocides that's really hard to explain because you don't see the obvious or evident differences between the people. That being said, I want to be really careful that we don't characterize Muslims the way you did. I want to characterize the Bashir government as having clearly, there I would agree with you, a notion that says that they get to say who's in their country and who isn't and in what situation. The Bashir government waged a 18-year civil war against the South. One of the issues in that civil war was their right to impose Muslim law, Sharia, on the Christian animist population in the south of the country. So it's this government as a I think, a really dangerous entity spreading, backing up with attacks their own vision of how they see the world. And that's so similar, in my mind, to what Pol Pot did in Cambodia, to what piece of what Hitler and the Nazis did during the Holocaust. It's like it's our world and we get to define it. So I think whenever any group defined by faith or nationality or ethnicity tries to assert its power over the rest of the world and say just get out of the way, the world has to find a way to respond. The most troubling issue here in some ways, Chris, you were onto this a little bit before, is that the United Nations is actually moving in the direction of saying that the powers that be in the world must exercise something called the responsibility to protect. They passed a responsibility to protect resolution in August 2005, a big step forward, saying if a government doesn't protect its own citizens, then the world for the first time is going to say, we have a responsibility to go in and be sure those citizens are protected. So it's a great resolution, but so far it's only a piece of paper.
Ruth, what do we know? If God willing, this could all end tomorrow, what can we extrapolate from other genocides in recent history about what the people of Darfur are still going to be dealing with in the years and the decades following this last 5 years?
Well, that's a very important question for American Jewish World Service, because one of the things we tell everybody we work with is we'll be there after the headlines and after the spotlight has gone away. So our understanding of our obligation to the people of Darfur is, to the extent that they're ready to be resettled and rebuild their villages, we'll be there to try to help do that to the extent that they have some further notion about how to put themselves and their peoples back together. We'll try to be there for that. But what do we know from past experience? It's very sobering. These are unbelievably traumatic experiences. On the one hand, when I'm in Darfur and Chad, I'm just staggered by people's resilience. Yes, they'll tell you their story, and these stories, I didn't go through it in a lot of detail, but gang rapes, losses of children being snatched off of mothers' bodies. I met a mother who has a scar on her back where the bullet wounded her, but that was after it killed the child she had on her back. I mean, this is not pretty stuff. And yet when you meet these people, there they are collecting firewood, waiting in line for the oil and grain that the World Food Program gives out because they still have families. They still have people to care for. So there's that resilience to admire. But you asked really nicely, what's our lesson from other situations? This past summer when I went to Chad, I went with this organization called Dream for Darfur that's sort of making the Olympic connection. The hero of the Dream for Darfur effort is Mia Farrow, the actress. And Mia Farrow and I and a basketball player and Jill Savitt, the head of Dream for Darfur, we traveled together. And we lit a symbolic torch in Chad in a refugee camp saying, this is the Olympic dream should be for these people, not just for the world's athletes. And then we went and did a similar torch lighting in Rwanda. That's why I reference this story, because in Rwanda, here's a country that lost 1 out of every 9 people in its population in 100 days. But here's a country that's managing to rebuild. And yet every person you talk to, if your conversation goes on more than 5 minutes, they talk about the psychological trauma, impact, notion that you can never quite trust people again.
Ruth Messenger is my guest. She's director of the American Jewish World Service in town for an address this evening at Temple Emmanuel on Hillcrest in Dallas. That'll take place at 7:30. We will return to our conversation in just a moment. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and travel start in March. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about the state of Darfur today and the plight of the refugees there with Ruth Messenger. She's director of the American Jewish World Service. You can see her speak tonight at 7:30 at Temple Emmanuel on Hillcrest in Dallas. She's there at the invitation of the Jewish Community Relations Council of Greater Dallas. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. It's almost hard to believe, Ruth, but apparently the economy in Sudan is growing. It's doing well. I wonder if you can talk about the impact of international investment and potentially divestment on what's taking place for the people in Darfur.
Yeah, it's a hard one. But the economy is growing because Sudan is an oil-rich country. The oil's in the south, which is why the powers that be between the north and the south sort of crafted this fragile so-called comprehensive peace agreement about 5 years ago, which right now is in more jeopardy than it's been in a while. That is, people think the South is not being rebuilt quickly and more trouble will break out. Meanwhile, the government sits on all this oil and they sell it. And China's their biggest customer and that's making them rich. And Khartoum itself, the capital of Sudan, you know, there's a construction crew on every corner. They're building the city. It's not true in the South. The South, which was devastated by the Civil War, isn't getting new investment and isn't getting rebuilt. There are lots of reasons for that. One of the reasons for that is Darfur. So you're going to have this government that becomes more and more comfortable and entrenched because of its wealth, but seems increasingly inclined to beat up on people. So then the question is investment, divestment. So I'm quite sure that there's lots and lots of foreign investment in Khartoum. But I do know that a whole significant piece of it is Chinese. And so when we have been part of a student-founded and student-led divestment campaign, God bless the students on these campuses, the notion was state by state and in the Congress and sometimes, by the way, university by university, let's target the bad guys. The bad guys are the 22 or so companies that are in the oil and weapons businesses, PetroChina, Sinotech, going back and forth between China and Sudan, Chinese-owned companies for the most part, buying oil, selling munitions. Let's see if we can divest some money from them. Let's see if state by state, and now it's 24 states, including Texas, can pass resolutions that say they don't want their pension funds being used to fuel this regime, to support genocide. That divestment effort has been sufficiently successful that the divestment groups, and the one I would refer people to is investorsagainstgenocide.org, have now launched an effort to go after individuals. So lots and lots of your listeners, through no malicious intent of their own, have a money market account. And that money market account may be, for example, with Fidelity. Fidelity has not agreed to stop buying stock in these companies. So we just, Investors Against Genocide, launched a stockholder resolution campaign, the very first one, against Fidelity's misuse of people's money to fuel a genocide. And although it may not sound great to you or the listeners, it got 28% of the vote, which is very, very unusual. And they're now spreading that. So you can go on Investors Against Genocide. The next time your money market sends you an email and just says, would you like to vote for this, that, or the other thing, look carefully, because there may be a resolution about the genocide in Darfur, and we need you to vote not to have your money spent there.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Richard in Dallas. Hi, Richard. Hi, Richard. Are you with us? Mm-mm. Okay, let's go to Deng in Dallas. Hi, Deng.
Chris, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And Ruth, good afternoon, and thank you very much for the hard work you did in Darfur. Actually, I'm from South Sudan, and I live in Dallas here.
Aha, thank
and,
you.
And I am going to go, I'm going there to take the school supply on June 15 with a group of churches. We call it Equation Missions. And I'm really very happy about the work you did. The work you did is not an easy work, but I got a question for you. You're really working hard to find, to get help to people of Darfur, because the world, right, we are confused. Even we are Sudanese, we are still confused. Anytime the government of Sudan can make a name, because as you said, when they were fighting, they said that the infidel they were attacking, the Muslim, Muslim was in, Islam was in danger. And now they are fighting the people of Darfur, and people of Darfur, in fact, they are Muslim. And that's why you hear that the Arab are killing the African. They have a name all the time. What is the role of the African Union? Have you talked to one of the African Union? Because there is a one who was elected in a few months ago.
Okay. First of all, let me thank you for your...
And my last question, you will answer both of them. What is the role of United Nations?
Okay.
Because United Nations, when something happened in Burma, people, the whole world will speak with one voice to condemn the regime right there.
Deng, thanks for your call.
Deng, thanks a lot for calling, and thanks for your own humanitarian work. I know there are many people who left South Sudan and who have, in fact, immigrated into the United States, and I'm glad to hear the kind of positive work you're doing. So I liked all the questions you said. I wish I could understand the motives of the Bashir government better than I do, because I surely get asked about that every time I speak. But you wanted to know sort of particularly what is the role of the UN?
The UN and also the African Union.
And the African Union. So let me say first the African Union. I think the African Union has tried very hard to carve out a position challenging the Bashir government, not allowing Bashir to rise to the presidency of the African Union, which he was supposed to do 2.5 years ago. The problem for the African Union is they were, for most of the last 4 years, the only peacekeeping force that Bashir would allow on the ground. They only had 7,000 people at the most from 6, 8, 10 different countries, most of them not really trained in peacekeeping. And the Bashir government kept sort of sideways launching attacks on them, stirring up fighting between and among them. So that they ended up a really very weak player, I think, to their embarrassment, because they were basically bunkered in. They were afraid to go out and do any peacekeeping because they kept getting picked off. So that's one of the reasons that many of us feel that the world has to come in a bigger way. Now, the UN issue is really fascinating to me. The UN has this responsibility to protect position, but they haven't really acted on it. They raised Darfur and what to do about Darfur 7 different times over the last 5 years. And then finally, last August, they said, okay, there needs to be a 26,000-person force, and we need to put that together under UN auspices. And China, who we just described a few minutes ago as being Sudan's protector, remember, Dang, that China has a veto in the Security Council. So China first said, we're not voting for this resolution unless you take out some of the sanctions. So Sudan's supposed to admit the force, but there's no punishment in the resolution if she doesn't admit the force. Then the Chinese voted for it. But in my judgment, they are not following through yet. They are not pushing Sudan. And that's why we're raising the issue of the Olympics. That's why if George Bush said, I think that the world leaders should listen to me, and none of us should go to these Olympics. Of course, the athletes should get to compete. But why should we honor the world? Why should we honor China with our presence on the ground if China can't use what we know is her sufficient authority to tell Sudan, let the peacekeeping force in on the ground? So it's, in my mind, the U.S. is trying, but the U.N. is trying, but the structure that it has to follow, which gives China a veto, is really limiting what it's able to do.
Let's talk for a minute about perception of strength of that force and how effective it can be. Currently, the plan is to scale it by the end of the year to 26,000. Currently, we're just 2,000 larger than the initial AU force. There are concerns that if the UN doesn't come in really strong, that people are going to write them off the same way they have done the AU. There are also questions as to whether that force should be native African or it should look Western to somehow project a greater degree of strength.
Well, I would be critical of the UN. It's a good follow-up question because I think they acceded too much to Bashir when he said, okay, we're going to admit the force, but it has to be all African. I thought that was ridiculous because we already know that, as you said, the African Union couldn't all do the job. And by the way, African countries, which are closer to the scene, have a lot of ambivalence about committing troops, not because they're not on the right side politically, which was Deng's question, but because the troops they just had in there weren't really able to be effective, and some of them got killed. And by the way, when you're on the ground there, you asked me this much earlier, and people say something to you about what they want, they say, we need peacekeepers who look like you. They want Westerners on the ground. So I wish the force was that the world powers led by the U.S. would be pushing for a more blended force, would accept there was I think Bashir just rejected the idea of troops from Thailand, that there would be troops from around Asia, Europe, Central South America. And I wish the U.S. would take the lead in saying, while we're not going to put troops on the ground, we're going to provide the helicopters, we're going to provide the funding, we're going to make it possible for this force to be much more effective than the African Union force.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Kathy in Dallas. Hello, Kathy.
You have a great program.
Thank you.
It's informative, and I appreciate what your guest is trying to do. Although it's just puzzling, I look around our society right here at home, and I see people with no health insurance, people who can't feed themselves or have no homes, elderly that are in trouble. And I think all this benevolence that we try to spread ourselves so thin to try to control the mindset and the cultures of different people around the world, and right here at home we have suffering that we're basically turning a blind eye to, or we have laws that, basically support people to continue to live in misery right here in America. And then I think about the economic part about China. And, I think not going to the Olympics, I don't know how you go if you're an athlete without a country, if you're just, you know, there to represent yourself. But I don't know if it's so fair to deny these athletes that have worked so long to go because we're trying to make a political statement, which really won't hold any water long term. I think long term we should control the trade that comes through China into our country. We are arming China basically to be wealthy and to be able to support these regimes.
Kathy, thank you. You made a lot of good points. I want to make sure that Ruth has a chance to address you before the hour ends. So thank you very much for your call.
Thanks a lot, Kathy. I'd love maybe sort of ending with this. Let me be clear. There are problems every place. There are problems in Dallas. There are problems in New York where I'm from. There are a lot of problems in the United States. Nothing is intended to sort of say because we're paying attention here, no one should pay attention anyplace else. I actually believe that as people privileged to live in the United States, each of us should pick where we most want to work. What are the injustices? What are the economic inequalities? What are the problems that just tear at your heart? For some, it will be local. For some, it will be national issues. And for some, it will be global issues. We have the capacity in this country to pay attention on all three of those levels. And by the way, I want to say some people listening to this program, this excellent program, had the capacity to pick a couple of issues. So to say that you ought to be concerned about Darfur, not because we're exporting our culture, Kathy, but because there is a genocide, because we just entered the sixth year of a government deliberately killing and displacing its own people, that's something that should compel you to go to our website, ajws.org, to take action, to write a letter, to speak in your mosque or church or synagogue about this issue, to email your friends. That, frankly, doesn't take so much energy that you can't also speak up for the people in your own city that you think aren't getting a fair shake, or that you can't write a check that says this is my most important charitable concern, whether it's local or national or global. We have the capacity to do more to help heal the world than we're currently doing. And I hope more of us will become upstanders and do that work.
Coming from AWS, which still has, you know, the specter of the Holocaust, as much of the world does, but certainly it's a particular issue for Jews. Watching this happen, Ruth, does forgiveness have a place in this yet? Can it possibly, as it's still going on, can you even start to think about the moment when healing starts to happen?
Let me put it differently. I haven't thought about it that way, but I do know from time in South Africa, time in Rwanda, that we have to imagine that in each of these countries that are torn apart, there will be a time where people sit down and move toward reconciliation.
Ruth Messenger is director of the American Jewish World Service, which has put the Darfur crisis at the forefront of its own humanitarian initiatives. She'll speak tonight at 7:30 at Temple Emmanuel on Hillcrest in Dallas. That address is free and open to the public. Ruth, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.